Well, good morning. Hope you're doing well. My name is Dean. If we haven't had the chance to meet yet, I'm the lead pastor here. And I appreciate you taking the time, whether you're here in the room, whether you're watching online, to be with us today as we're jumping into week number two of a series that we're calling Hand in Hand, as we're looking at the Old Testament book of Ruth. And kind of like I said last week, like the great thing about Ruth is like it's kind of like the blue-collar lunchbox right, book of the Bible. There's no special effects, right? There's no Red Sea partings. There's no burning bushes, right? It's a book about things that we all experience. It's a book about grief and loss. It's a book about the gray area decisions that we make, the family disruption that comes along time, and the deficits that we have because of that. It's a book about coming home and God's redeeming love for his people. So just in case you weren't here last week, let's do a little Ruth recap from chapter one. There's a man, his name is Elimelech, and he is married to Naomi. Looks like a solid family. They live in Bethlehem, in Israel, in the promised land that they've just moved into, right? They have two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. Things get a little tough in Bethlehem. So Elimelech and Naomi decide they're going to move their family out of Bethlehem, out of the promised land, and they look southeast to a country called Moab. Now, Moab worships idols. It's a Canaanite tribal people. One of the gods that they worship is Chemosh. And you'll read that some places, like you'll see his name in the Old Testament. I know sometimes you read things and you're like, is that just something somebody made up, right, in the Bible? But actually, in the Moabite ruins, the archaeological ruins that have been discovered, they found Chemosh's name. There's a very famous artifact called the Moabite Stone. I'll show you a picture right up there of the Moabite Stone, and Chemosh is listed up there. Now, the problem that God has with Chemosh, his primary beef, right, with the people worshiping him, is that Chemosh, he requires human ritualistic sacrifices, sometimes child sacrifices. So if you can think about Elimelech and Naomi making a decision, right? They're leaving the promised land that God has provided for his people, and they're moving out from underneath that covering to a country and a culture that is absolutely antithetical, right, to what God is calling them to and the way that God is calling them, that he's calling them to live. Now, they live there for about 10 years. Mahlon and Chilion, the two sons, they marry Moabite women, Ruth and Orpha. In the process of 10 years, all three males die. Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion, they all die. So at the end of a decade, you have Naomi with two daughters-in-law, right? Ruth and Orpha. She tells them she's moving back to Bethlehem. There's no reason for her to stay in Moab. She doesn't really have extended family there. She's not going to be able to provide for herself there. It's going to be very difficult for her to provide for herself in Bethlehem. But she's going to go home. She encourages her daughters-in-law, stay in Moab, remarry. You're young. You can have children. You can have families and legacy. Orpah says, you know what? You're right. I'm going to stay here in Moab with my people. However, Ruth says, these are the verses we focused on last week in chapter 1, verse 16 and 17. Like, she says to Naomi, like, you don't understand. Where you go, Naomi, I'm going. Your people, my people. Your house, where you lodge, I lodge. Your God, my God. That's the critical thing. She says, listen, Naomi, I've never seen Chemosh. Chemosh has never done anything for me as a God. But your God, Yahweh, I see something different. So I'm with you wherever you go. I'm going to be with you. And so the two of them pack up in Moab and they leave and they head back. They head back to Bethlehem. Now, on the way back, I'm sure that Naomi explained to Ruth what kind of life is out in front of them. What's ahead of them. But right at the end of chapter one, you get the last verse. You get just a little bit of foreshadowing about what's coming in chapters 2 and 3. So Ruth chapter 1, verse 22, it says this. So Naomi returned, and Ruth, the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now, that's like I said, foreshadowing in a good book, right? They're coming into Bethlehem at the barley harvest, and that is not accidental, right? It is providential. God has brought them here during this moment, this time, and in this season. So the whole idea of this series, hand in hand, talking about the providence of God and how our plans work in the context of that, it doesn't work the way we think a partnership works, right? Whenever you start a business, let's say, and you make an agreement with another business owner, you sit down at the table, you iron out the agreement, and when you're done, you stand up, and what do? You reach out, and you shake hands, right? And what are you saying kind of in that is, hey, we'll draw up the paperwork, but I'm gonna keep up my part of the deal, you're gonna keep up your part of the deal. Or you think about two people who are maybe interested in one another romantically. And so they're walking alongside of each other and all of a sudden their hands do this and one of them reaches out and takes the other one's hand. And that's a way of saying, I'm interested. Are you interested? At South Point Middle School, when you got to this, when you got to interlocking fingers, I mean, you might as well be getting married, right? But that's what it says. It says, I'm interested, right? And you're interested as well. That's not how we think about us and the providence of God, right? Jesus says in John chapter 10, he says to his disciples, his followers, he says, listen, no matter what happens, you're in my hand. And my hand is in the Father's hand, and no man can take you out of my hand. See, it's not nearly as important, right, that we are holding on to God as it is that God is the one who's holding on to us. We hold God's hand like a child holds a parent's hand walking through the Costco parking lot, right? Right. The child may pull a little this way. The child may pull a little that. It doesn't matter, right? Because the parent does all of the holding. The child does all of the holding on. And that's what it's like for us with the providence, the way that God provides for us. That's how it is for us with the providence of God. So the way I'm going to say it to you today is this, that God's providence is always way ahead of our plans. God's providence is always way ahead. However far ahead you think you are, God is way ahead of you. So they come into this, to the barley harvest, and it's almost like God's been like, waiting on it to happen, right? This is a setup. The whole thing is rigged. Now, there is an important side note here that God provided for his people a system of social care. He does it in a variety of ways. One of the ways that he does that is during the harvest season. It's set up in Leviticus 19 and Leviticus 23. So whenever you were reaping grain or you were reaping barley, right? And as you were taking in your barley or taking in your grain, you would drop some pieces on the ground. As a reaper, you were not allowed to be thorough. You couldn't reach down and pick up what you dropped. God set up a system of social care where people would come along, maybe who were impoverished for some reason, who had made a bad decision, they were gone through a bankruptcy or whatever, and people would come behind the reapers, right? And they'd come along and they'd try and pick up piece by piece. And they'd try and gather enough, right, to make a cake or something at the end of the day. So Ruth knows on her way back to Bethlehem, when Naomi, that her life is gonna be doing a lot of this. A lot of hard, laborious work. She's got it. She knows what is out there and what's in front of her. So when you get over into Ruth chapter 2, we'll pick it up in verse 4 if you have a copy of the scriptures and you wanna turn there. Ruth has gone reaping. And she happens into the field of this guy, verse 4. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." And then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" So Boaz he's a boss, right? He's a literal boss. Like, he comes into the field, right? He owns the field. He owns the barley crop, right, that's there. And he comes in and he says to the reapers, he says to his boys on his team, "The Lord bless you." And his boys say, "No, the Lord bless you, man. Now, I don't know what it's like when you work, but I don't know very many bosses who roll into the office and look at everybody like, the Lord bless y'all. No, the Lord bless you, man. Like, so he's got a good relationship, right, with his fellows. But the next thing he says is he looks over everything that's happening out in the reaping and the fields and the crop and all that. And he's like, whoa. This young woman, there's Ruth out there picking up little pieces of grain. And when Boaz sees Ruth for the first time, it is like, cue the music. Right? I mean, it's like all of a sudden for Boaz, he's like, man, who is this? And he realizes that he kind of knows who she is. And the rest of the next group of verses, right, in chapter two there, moving forward after verse 5, is Boaz trying to get to know Ruth. And so what he says to her, he says, hey, Ruth, listen, if you get thirsty, you don't have to worry about water. We got water. You can come. You can come get some of our water. Now look, he says, I've told my reapers, I've told my boys not to touch you. So if any one of them gives you grief, you come and tell me, Ruth, it's all good. There's a moment where they sit down to eat, and Boaz looks at Ruth, and he says, Ruth, come dip your morsel of bread in my wine. I wish I could say that with like a Barry White voice, right? I mean, this is like a Hebrew riz, right? At its finest. You watch them work back and forth. And so Ruth eventually realized, listen, Ruth's not expecting this, right? Her hair's up in a dirty bun. She's sweaty down on the ground. She's doing work. And Ruth says to Boaz, she says, why all of this kindness? And you know what Boaz does not say to Ruth? He's like, girl, you straight up Moab fire, man. I mean, like, you're the, like, he doesn't say that. You know what he says to her? He says, because I have heard of how you left your people. I have heard of how you left your country and you came to be one of our people. I have heard, he says, of your kindness to Naomi. To come, for you to come, to leave your people, to come here, to take care of Naomi, and because of your love for our God. Boaz says, oh, I've heard all about it. And here's Ruth's response in chapter 2, in verse 13. Then she said, if I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your, what's the next word? Say it again, what's the next word?
Servant.
She said, you have spoken kindly to your servant. So look, I don't have a ton of time to spend on this, but let me say this. Young dating people, old dating people, old married still trying to date each other people. What you learn here from Boaz is very simple. Character greater than chemistry. Character greater than chemistry. Now look, it's not that chemistry doesn't matter. It does. But it is secondary to character. Boaz says to Ruth, he's like, listen, all the attraction, all that's all great. But what I see in you is deep character, the character of a servant. And what draws me to you What draws me to you is that. As a matter of fact, Boaz says to his fellows, to the reapers, he says, look, guys, if you see Ruth and she wanders over into the unharvested grain, now this is his crop, this is his money, right? He's like, you just let her go. It's almost like he says, look, if you look behind you and you see Ruth is behind you picking up grain, like just give a little bit of that right there, right? But it's because he sees something. He's drawn to her because of something in her character. So Ruth goes home that night with a bunch of barley. Like her robe is loaded up with barley. She goes home, and if you can imagine her talking to Naomi, right? Talking about, hey, you're never gonna believe what happened. I went to this field, blah, 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 blah. And then she says, and his name is Boaz. And Naomi says in verse 20, may he be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living nor the dead. And she's talking about the Lord there, not Boaz, right? Whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi also said to her, this man is a very close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. Now, this is super important in the book of Ruth. We'll talk more about it next week. But there was a law, again, a law for social care, whereby if there was somebody who was a widow and they had given up their family land, maybe they'd hit in a rough spot financially, she could get her land back, but the only way was that that land had to be redeemed. And what that meant was a relative of theirs had to be willing to buy the land back, whatever their financial debts were, whatever they had lost. He had to pay for it financially. So there's a payment. And then he had to marry someone from the widow's family into his family, which would cause, you know, all kinds of problems with his existing family, because that meant the inheritance was going to change and it was going to be more spread out. So it was very, very rare that that ever happened, but the law was on the books. And so Naomi says to Ruth, hey, 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 he's a distant relative. And so Ruth looks at Naomi and she quotes that great theologian Lloyd Christmas, and she says, so you're saying there's a chance, right? And you look at the story as it moves forward in chapter 3, and the only way that I could, if chapter 3 had a title, it would be Weirdest Date Night Ever, right? Because Naomi starts to give Ruth dating advice, and here's what she says in verse 2. See, he Boaz, is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. So I'm going to show you a picture of a threshing floor so you get a feel for it. It's a big, wide, open spot. Most times it was like a hard rock. They would take barley stalks, they would slam them on the ground, and what would happen is that would help separate the barley or the wheat sometimes from the chaff, and the wind would blow the chaff. Think about like a peanut, right? That little coating that's on the outside, that's chaff, right? So the wind would blow that away and leave the grain or the kernels there. Why are they doing it at night? Well, two reasons. One, it's cooler. And number two, there's more wind, right, to blow the chaff away. So here's what she says, verses 3 and 4. Continuation, here's the dating advice. Wash, therefore, great advice, take a shower. Especially to you junior high boys, take a shower, right? You're gonna go on a date. Anoint yourself, maybe put on some perfume. Second thing, great advice. Put on your cloak, go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, now so what she knows is gonna happen is that when he is harvesting his crop, when he's done for the night, he's gonna lay down and he's gonna sleep there. He's gonna guard the grain. Raiding parties would constantly come in during the harvest time, and they would go farm to farm, land to land, right? And they would try to steal what was there. So Boaz and his boys, they're staying there, they're sleeping, and they're guarding the grain. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Now, Naomi's done a pretty good job with dating 101 up to this point, but here she says, don't do anything, just sit there and watch him sleep. That's kind of weird. I don't know what's going on there, right? Observe the place where he lies, then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. Let's hit a pause button on the story there for a second. So what we're seeing in this back and forth in chapters 2 and 3 is that God's invincible plan often comes through, works its way through his invisible providence. So God's plan is working behind the scenes in ways that Ruth and Naomi, that they can't see. But it's always at work, way, way ahead of what they thought and where they thought they were and what their circumstances were. See, Elimelech and Naomi, I think, in the beginning of the book, they make this decision. They're like, hey, it's kind of a tough moment right now, but look, we'll go to Moab. We had a good plan here, we'll have a good plan there. We did well here, we'll do well there. We're successful here, we'll be successful there. Now, I don't think for a second that Elimelech and Naomi didn't pray. I would say almost 100%, when you're making a decision like this, like you're gonna look up and say, okay, God, we want to know your plan. We want to know, God, should we do this or should we not do this? Should we make this move or should we not make this move? What I would say is that I think what Elimelech and Naomi probably do and what you and I have the tendency to do is at moments where we have to make a difficult, critical decision, so many times what we're saying when we say, God, show us the plan, is, God, tell me how this is all gonna work out for my happily ever after moment. Does it make sense? You see, Elimelech and Naomi, from my perspective, they make a bad decision. And they make a bad decision because they didn't consider what's most important to God. Instead, what they considered first was what was most important to them. So in other words, they were saying, hey God, this is all gonna work out. And by the way, I've got a few details for you about how all of this is gonna happen and how it's all gonna work its way out. Now the good news for you and me is that God's invincible plan, it works its way out through God's invisible providence. So here's the thing. You and I can't do anything to change God's plan. We can't do it, right? God's working his plan out to restore us to a new heaven, new earth, in a place for eternity. No more tears, no more sadness, no more sorrow, no more death. And we are on that train and we're gonna get there, right? One way or another, God's people are gonna get there. And it doesn't matter which decisions we make in the context of, we're not, God's plan is invincible. No matter what decisions you and I make, God will use those decisions to glorify himself. Now that doesn't exempt us from consequences. So it's really important how we relate to the providence of God. So come back to Naomi's advice. Here's what she says in verse 7. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, his heart was merry. And he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she, Ruth, came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. All right, so if you can imagine, here's Naomi sitting at home wondering how all this is gonna work out. The failure, right, of Elimelech and Naomi was what? They never asked the question, is this the best decision for my family spiritually? That was the lead question they should have asked. But really, instead they said, well, how's this help me? How's this help us, right? And that's gotten them to where they are. And now, Ruth goes in. She uncovers Boaz's feet. So you, first of all, the uncover the feet thing, right? That's odd. Like, is she doing something promiscuous here, right? Is she asking for something? No and yes. It's not promiscuous, but she is asking for something. See, listen, Ruth doesn't need a one-night stand. What Ruth needs is covenant marriage. Ruth needs a redeemer. So by going and laying down at Boaz's feet, what she's saying is, hey, I'm here for redemption. I'm here, I'm available for marriage. If that's what's on your mind, if that's what's in your heart, right? Look at the verse, look how it works out in verse eight. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, who are you? She said, I am Ruth. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. Listen, Taylor Swift has never written lyrics that good right there. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. So we'll push pause there on the story, and that's where we'll pick it up next week. But here's what happens. Boaz sends Ruth home with 60 pounds of barley. Now, if you think about 60 pounds, right? Ruth must have been jacked, right? She must have been really strong. But you know how it is, man. When you find yourself in a desperate situation, you can do a lot of things that maybe you couldn't otherwise do. So Boaz sends Ruth home with a message. He says, listen, don't you worry. I'm gonna take care of all of this. I've made a mess, right? So I just wonder if Ruth ever wondered. I wonder if Ruth ever laid underneath the stars at night after she had gotten to Bethlehem, after a long day of picking up grain after grain after grain after grain. And I wonder if Ruth ever wondered, how did I get here? Most of the time in our lives, those moments of reflection come after a bad decision, or in a moment of maybe depression, or in moments, it's a feeling sometimes where you don't know, is it right or left, up, down, good, bad, like, how did I get, I don't mean how did I get here by origin story, I mean more by cause and effect, right? A lot like the butterfly effect, right? It's a chaos theory where you think about how a butterfly half the world away flaps its wings, creates a puff of wind and flapping its wings that creates a chain reaction of events that causes a tornado half the world away. And there are times in our lives where we find ourselves thinking things like, if I had just chosen this, if I had chosen X, then what I would be experiencing now would be Y instead of Z. I wish I could go back and undo this. And a lot of times we get caught in the paralysis of analysis, right? In the navel gazing about how we could have changed this. We could have done this. What if we could just fix this? And then all the results will be different. So the question that I think it brings up for us from Ruth is, when you find yourself in that spot, what do you do when you don't know what to do? When you feel caught, what do you do? I've got a great answer for you from the scriptures. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 9 says this: the heart of a man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. Listen, there's nothing wrong with coming up with a plan, making a plan, trying to execute a good plan. That's all good. But listen, the Lord is the one who's in charge. The Lord is the one who's in charge of your steps. And there is nothing that God will not use to accomplish his ultimate plan. The best of you, the worst of you, he can use all of it to glorify himself. Again, doesn't exempt us right from the consequences, but our lives sit at the intersection of our plans and God's providence. They sit right there. So what do you do when you don't know what to do? You do exactly what Ruth did. You go back to what you know to do. Three times in this chapter, or in chapters 2 and 3, we've read them all. We've read all three of them. What does it say? You go back to chapter 2 and verse 13, right? She says this: then she said, I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have indeed spoken kindly to your what? Servant. Listen, Ruth chapters 2 and 3 are not a how-to in terms of dating. They are a what for in terms of trusting. What we learn from Ruth is that in moments and seasons when you don't know what to do, you do the things that you know to do. When she comes to Boaz and she says, spread your wings over your servant, for you are my redeemer. What she's saying to Boaz is, Boaz, I've studied the word, right? These are verse references. These are ideas that comes from Exodus, where it says that we will ride on the wings of God. The Redeemer law comes from Leviticus and Deuteronomy. What she's saying is, listen, I'm invested. I'm invested in your God. I'm invested in your people. When you don't know what to do, go back to what you know to do. And that's the reason when you walk through our lobby and you look up at the other side of the lobby, we have five core values. There are five things that we would say as a church. When you don't know what to do, you can go back to these five basic things that are clearly outlined in Scripture. And the one that we see the most in Ruth is this idea of personal ministry. And we say personal ministry, we say personal ministry means that we are servants. So when you don't know what to do, one thing that you know to do is to use your spiritual gifting. God gives every believer a supernatural gift in the context of your life experience and circumstances to be used for the benefit of the body. Romans chapter 12, verse 6 says this, having gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, let us use them. So whenever you came in today, you should have gotten a card that looks something like this. And we would just ask, if you're not currently serving, using your gifts somewhere in the context of the body, that you would just fill this card out. You would drop it off at Guest Central as you're leaving today. And we will reach out to you and begin a conversation about where you could potentially serve. If you're listening online today, there are links in the app notes where you can go there, fill out a link for upcoming Life Teams orientation and hear about opportunities to serve and to use your gifts. Ruth, her part of her identity is anchored in that reality that she says, I'm a servant. God just reminded me of that this week. Not because I'm a pastor, but because I'm a believer, that I see myself as a conduit of God's work through my life. But what I fear for us a lot of times is that a lot of our time and energy and effort, I believe, is lived in trying to figure out and live in the scarcity of God's providence. I feel like for a lot of us, we find ourselves down here on the ground, and it's like cafeteria style Christianity. It's like, oh, there's peace. Oh, I want peace. Oh, here's what the scripture says about marriage and sexuality, and I don't want that part. Here's hope. Yeah. I need hope. But here's what God says about controlling my anger, my attitude. I don't want that part. What I need, oh, joy. Yes. Give me more. Can I find more? I want more joy. But wait a minute, this idea that I have to learn patience, I don't want that part, right? And we're living our lives in the little bits, it's just the little crumbs, and we're never satisfied and we're never fulfilled. We're living in the scarcity of God's providence. But what if you and I would live in abundance? What does Jesus say in John chapter 10, verse 10? I have come that you might have life and that you might have it more. What's the next word? Abundantly. Jesus said, I came, I went to the cross, I died for your sins so that you could have this huge, abundant life. And you're like, yeah, man, I want the abundant life because I think the abundant life means I'm going to be rich. And it does. But not in the way you're thinking, rich. I want the abundant life because that means I'll get to marry my dream guy or my dream girl. It does. But not in the way that you're probably thinking about that. Because I can tell you, I know a lot of people who live in a really, really big house, but to be honest, they're not wealthy. They're not spiritually fulfilled and satisfied living in abundance. I know a lot of people who've got great Instagram pictures, right, with their significant other. But can I tell you, that's just the picture. If you look behind the film, they're not living in relational abundance. But I can tell you this, and I'm so grateful for it. I grew up in a 1,200 square foot house. There were six of us. I shared a bedroom with my older brother the majority of the time I was there. And so what it wasn't in the American dream, what it wasn't and what most of us maybe would see as a happily ever after. Can I tell you, we had it all. Because my mom and my dad, they were on the same page spiritually and they led us in that way. And I when I was a kid, I remember Christmas would come, Thanksgiving would come, our family would get together, and my mom, who was our church pianist, she would get at the piano, and my dad would drag us all in, and I'm a teenage kid, and I'm like, oh, we're gonna sing these songs again. And I hated it. And what I wouldn't do today, to sit around that piano with my mom playing. What a day that will be when my Jesus I shall see, when I look upon his face, the one who saved me by his grace, when he takes me by the hand to lead me to the promised land. What a day, what a day that'll be. If we have those moments where we can lean into the providence and the abundance of God, and what we can say to God is, God, I'm not in charge. I've got a plan, and this is how I'd like the plan to work. But whatever your plan is, I like your plan better. And I don't just want part of it. I want all of it. I don't want to know your plan just so I can consider it among my other options. I want your plan because I believe that your providence is best. You proved it on the cross. You proved it in the resurrection. So I trust it. Let's pray together. God, as we have the opportunity now to see people taking steps in baptism, these are the first steps to identify with your providential care in our lives. And so God, we rejoice. We worship you, not the moment, but we worship you because you're the God who's so far ahead of us. We're saying, God, this morning that we love you and that we trust you. Save us from living in the scarcity of our little dreams and plans. In your name we pray. Amen. Would you stand with me?